You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Alistair MacLeod, Senior Fellow at the Gold Money Foundation and Head of Research at goldmoney.com. Thanks for joining me again, Alistair.
That's my pleasure, Jay.
Always good to talk to you. Always good to pick your brain on your latest missive or one of your latest articles that you wrote for Gold Money. And the one I'd like to ask you about and have you share with my listeners is why interest rates are rising long term. You wrote that on November 22nd. Certainly today, interest rates are not rising. The equity market's getting hit very hard here in the U.S., and the bond markets are the recipient of the money flows going in there and driving rates down. But in the introduction to your November 22nd article, you wrote, and I quote, "There are growing expectations that the current cycle of rising interest rates will result in a deflationary recession. While a credit crisis is increasingly likely to evolve in the coming months, it is a highly inflationary situation." So my question to you is, why so? After all, we have had we've usually seen decreases in prices during credit crises and recessions that follow. So why might it be different this time?
Well, it's different this time, Jay, because there's just so much money sloshing around the system. Mm-hmm. I mean, following the Lehman crisis, the Fed increased substantially bank reserves. I mean, they went from virtually nothing, $10 billion roughly, to $2.5 trillion? I mean, I can't remember quite what the top was. The accumulation of savings and checking accounts and cash in the system just went on up and up and up and up. And it accelerated at a far higher rate than the long-term trend rate that we have seen over the last 30 to 40 years. And that has an effect. It is monetary inflation, which leads to price inflation. Mm-hmm. And in that article, I argued that price inflation, because of the way the CPI is calculated, is actually grossly underestimated.
I have no doubt about that. You and I have talked about that in the past. It seems to me that you're suggesting, however, that we may be looking at a loss of confidence in currencies, if I'm understanding your article. Certainly the last go-round, the dollar got stronger, at least initially. Prices did decline. You're saying this time we might start, people might actually start to not believe the government's inflation numbers?
Yes. The point about believing government statistics is that if the trend is in such a if the trend is in such a way that the statistics are confirming, and the statistics are telling you what you want to hear because mm-hmm. you're in the market, then that's absolutely fine. You don't question the government statistics. But when things start going wrong, people start saying, hold on a minute, what actually is the rate of inflation? I mean, if you look at the last 5 years, the purchasing power of the dollar, the dollar of 5 years ago, the dollar of today is only 91 cents of what it was 5 years ago. That's according to the CPI. Yeah. And if you look at a fixed basket of goods, it's lost something like 40% over that period of time. And this is a very substantial difference, the difference between what the government tells us and the reality that we face as individuals, if you like, in our day-to-day lives. And it's when you start questioning those things, and when you find that government bond yields start rising for some reason which nobody can understand, and it starts upsetting the government finances, and suddenly you see that not only have we got trillion-dollar deficits, but you're going to be adding to that a cost of finance, which is going to become very material on top of it. And where does this end? You start asking these questions, it's a completely different environment. So what I was suggesting is that you know, if you look at the chart of, say, the 10-year Treasury yield, which I showed in that article, you can see that that downtrend has now been broken and it's gone up. Now, admittedly, since that chart came out, there has been a fairly sharp decline in yields. But nonetheless, that long-term trend does appear to be to have been broken. And as that trend starts moving in the opposite direction, you will find that suddenly a whole load of things which we took for granted in the past, we can no longer take for granted, like the government CPI figure is a true reflection of inflation. And you begin to sort of look at things in a rather different light. And that is called a bear market. The trend has changed and your thinking changes with it.
Well, I think, Alistair, your point is well taken, that when we hear what we like to hear, well, we hear what we want to hear, we don't question it. But it's when we start hearing things that are distasteful to us that we start to dig a little deeper into what is really going on. And I'm thinking a lot of people in middle America that voted for Trump don't have any problem believing what you just said, that inflation is much higher than what the government says it is. On the other hand, the folks, the recipients of Wall Street wealth, are saying, inflation? What inflation? I don't notice any difference in my ability to pay my rent and buy my groceries and do the things you have to do to stay alive. So I think that's very interesting. So all of a sudden now, you know, and the notion on Wall Street, of course, is that the Federal Reserve is in control. Central banks have everything under control. Now, interest rates are starting to rise and they say, oh, well, that's a good thing because it shows the economy so strong. But now maybe it isn't all that strong. We see the housing market starting to get hit hard here in the U.S. and a lot of other things that look maybe not as strong as people think they are. So do you think that rates are rising no matter what the Fed does? Is it out of their control ultimately?
Yes, I think it is. It is out of their control. There comes a point where they become very reluctant to raise interest rates because of the cost on government finances, apart from anything else, and the supposed effect on businesses. I mean, we have a credit cycle, and that is unarguable. And the credit cycle consists of parts which include, at the end of that cycle, a rise in interest rates to the point where a slump is created in the economy. And that's what we saw back in 2008-09. It's what we saw back in 2001-02. Going back, it's been a repetitive cycle. So the thing that is beyond doubt is that interest rates will rise over the course of this cycle. Now, there is an interruption in this, which we're seeing over tariffs. And I think this is quite an interesting point. Mm-hmm. Let me take you back to around about September, October 1929. Wall Street started to crash in those months, and particularly over the course of October. Started at the tail end of September and then crashed through October. Mm-hmm. On October the 31st, the first vote on the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act passed the two houses, and the effect of that was that, just tying those two events together, people in the market knew that it was going to get passed. They knew in early October that this was going to be a fundamental change, if you like, for the market, and so they sold it heavily. We're now in a situation where we have run up to an increase in tariffs on China, which until this last weekend was due to happen on January the 1st. Mm-hmm. We can see that President Trump believes in one thing and one thing only, and that is tariffs. It's a war he reckons he can win. In fact, he even tweeted today, if I can just find it, it's worth me repeating this. I am a tariff man. When people or countries come in to raid the great wealth of our nation, I want them to pay for the privilege of doing so. It will always be the best way to max out our economic power. We are right now talking in billions of dollars in tariffs. Make America rich again. And that's signed by the real Donald Trump. And that was tweeted at 10 o'clock EST today. So that basically is Donald Trump repeating what Senator Smoot and Representative Hawley was doing 90 years ago. And guess what? We have got a stock markets which are having, I think at the very least, a rather nasty wobble in the middle of all this tariff talk. Now, probably going a bit too far to tie what happened in October 1929 with what's going on in the stock market today, but I do notice the similarities.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly as I look at the market right now, we're down 764. That's about a 3% decline. It's certainly not as cataclysmic as anything we saw I didn't see it. I wasn't quite here then yet. But what we saw in 1987, of course, and more recently in 2008, we've seen some massive declines. But it does seem to be wobbling a bit. And certainly, as Michael Oliver said earlier, he's convinced that we've seen the tops in the equity markets and probably in for some nasty surprises to the downside. Time will tell. Alistair, David Stockman has been on this show, has emphasized the fact that we're running these huge deficits at a time when the economy is at the top of the cycle. I mean, it's supposed to be the deficit under Keynesian ideas were to run the deficits at the bottom to try to stimulate the economy. But here we are at the top, running 200, what we're running, 100, huge deficits. I think we're something like $22 billion in total debt now in the United States. So 1% increase will 1% increase in rates will, you know, raise $22 billion. What if I got my $220 billion?
$220 billion
with our $22 trillion. $22 trillion in debt.
Yes.
1% is $220 billion additional. So, reading your article, you're suggesting that this time, the central banks will not be able to do what they did before. They'll not be able to print huge amounts of money and restart the engines again.
That's right. The problem this time, Jay, is that they've already printed the money like last time, and that hasn't actually sort of cleared through the system. There is too much money already in the system. So if the Fed tries that remedy again, all it'll happen is that it must crash the dollar. And I can't see that anything else can possibly happen. So that is a major change between what's likely to happen in the coming months and what happened back in at the time of the Lehman crisis, which was sort of August, September 2008. Mm-hmm. A very important difference.
Now, in terms of, I guess I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about how did we get ourselves in this mess? And you talk about Keynesian economics, his disbelief in Say's Law. Talk to us a little bit about Say's Law and what that meant and how Keynes pushed aside Keynes Law and has everybody buying into the notion that government can create capital, state-sponsored capitalism, if you will, or state-sponsored capital central banks create money out of nothing, as opposed to the old-fashioned way during the days when Say's Law was revered, in which savings was the starting point or was the origin of capital. Talk to us about why that has been so damaging and explain how that connects with where we are today.
Yes, certainly. Say's Law is, if you like, the central tenet of classical economics. Basically, what Say's Law describes is why it is that we go to work to produce things that we specialize in, the things that we are skillful at, in order to buy the things that we're not skillful at producing. And we do that basically by selling our goods for money. And that money is, if you like, the temporary storage of our labor while we spend it. And we spend that in two ways. We spend it immediately on the things we want, and we reserve some of it for the future because life is uncertain and we might fall ill or something like that. And we need a cushion of money against that possibility. But we don't just sit on it. We recycle that money to someone who needs that money in order to invest in the business, to develop new products, and so on and so forth. And we get the fact that we do without the use of that money, we get paid a return for that. And that is a rate which is set at the market, in the market. Both the proportion of the money that is taken, you know, that is saved, and also the rate at which is paid is actually set in the market, and it is set by the demand of business for that capital. Now, what Keynes did was he redefined that in such a way that was really gobbledygook, and this is in his general theory. And he had to do that because in order to recommend a system whereby government can intervene in the free markets to try and make it better, he had to get the idea over that free markets were not perfect in any way and were subject to failure, and that Say's law could be ignored or should be ignored. And so that was why he introduced the whole idea of Say's law. If you go on in his general theory and into the conclusions towards the end of that book, he expresses a wish. And the wish is that savers are not required to finance industry. He described it as the euthanasia. He looked forward to the euthanasia of the saver, or the rentier, as he rather disparagingly calls the saver, because he sees the saver as someone who is idle, rich, doing nothing, not getting hands dirty, not working, and just living on the back of his capital. And that to him was a sort of fundamentally morally wrong, in the same way that the church over years has looked at usury as being something wrong and has always had this debate about interest rates and, you know, the morality of it and all the rest of it. Anyway, he came down very strongly against it, and he anticipated in his wishes, if you like, in the conclusion, that the capital for entrepreneurs would be provided by the state. And furthermore, the entrepreneurs taking capital from the state would use it effectively. Now, that was where he was going in terms of his general direction, and it is so obviously wrong. But whenever you talk to a Keynesian economist, they actually adore the man. They believe in it. It's quite horrific. Yes. Anyway,
Alistair, of course, you mentioned that money goes from savings. People put it as a storage of their savings so that they can consume in the future or use it in the future for returns to invest. But I guess state-sponsored capitalism doesn't really allow the price discovery of savings, right? It distorts the price discovery of capital. And David Stockman has talked on this show already, but how can you have capitalism if you don't allow capital to be priced?
Well, that's absolutely right. The state cannot determine the price of anything because that is not their function. The function of the state is to, if you like, sort of protect us, to make the laws and so on. And it then wanders off into the territory of destroying wealth, or the way they would put it, redistributing money from the rich to the poor, socializing wealth, if you like. But it is actually destroying wealth. They have absolutely no means of being able to judge any prices at all. And even when they try and destroy wealth by transferring it to people who need welfare. The intention isn't necessarily to destroy wealth, but they end up doing it anyway. And we saw the logical effect of this when the Iron Curtain finally fell in the late 1980s, and we saw just how impoverished everybody was in if you like, sort of the nirvana of socialism, the Soviet Union.
Right, exactly. Well, it's just about a minute left, Alistair. I think what you're telling us is that we're heading for some very serious inflationary periods of time ahead of us, probably, when it's going to be more and more difficult for people to be able to afford the basic needs of life, the middle class at least, to be able to do that. What should individuals be doing? And then I should mention that in your article, you said there is an escape route for government, in which I think you're hinting that those who suffered under socialism before, namely China and Russia, have sort of figured it out, and they're actually going to a sound base of money to an extent from what we can see into gold. What advice do you have with a minute left for our listeners?
Well, I would certainly follow the direction of the Russians and the Chinese with respect to gold. Gold isn't an investment. It is actually money, but it's money that retains its purchasing power. So if you have your savings or a portion of your savings in physical gold, you have money to be able to spend at a future date. And if in dollar terms, the price of a barrel of oil goes to $1 million, your gold will still buy the same amount of oil as it does today.
Okay. All right. Well, that's very well put. And I thought it was very interesting. Your article did go into some details with regard to the activities of China and Russia. And I think that's a subject that we'll want to talk to you more about sometime in the near future. Alistair, I thank you very much for being with us and look forward to doing it again sometime in the near future.
That was very much my pleasure, Jay. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, folks, that is all the time we have for this week. Next week, I expect to be talking to David McElvaney. I want to hear what he has to say and what his views are as we head into the new year. Also, the price of uranium is starting to rise a bit now from after a long, long bear market. And Amir Adnani of Uranium Energy Corp will be with me. Also, with a little luck, we'll have Michael Oliver back again. So until next week, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
A gold rush has begun. Recently, three of the largest gold mining companies announced strategic acquisitions in the Yukon Territories. Ahead of them was a group who had already consolidated the key claims covering the historic Klondike Gold Rush into one company, aptly named Klondike Gold Corp. Led by a team of accomplished geoscientists, the company is steadily advancing exploration to reveal the rich source of all that gold. The hunt for the next major discovery is well underway, and Klondike Gold's shareholders are strategically positioned. Stay ahead of the majors and follow KlondikeGoldCorp.com.
Often referred to as one of the best teams in junior gold exploration, having discovered a 5-million-ounce gold mine and sold a second company amidst discovery, the management behind Orin Resources now has a world-class exploration portfolio within Canada and Peru. Projects that give the company one of the largest direct pipelines for major discoveries globally, with one of the deepest technical teams to explore them. Entering into its third year of aggressive pursuit, Orin is expecting results from two of their major projects throughout the rest of this year. For the latest, head to orinresources.com and subscribe.